This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, January 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Yesterday, on his first day in the White House, President Joe Biden signed 17 executive orders. Among them were orders recommitting the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement, canceling the planned Keystone XL oil pipeline, and ordering federal agencies to reinstate regulations on greenhouse gas emissions, drilling, and dozens of other threats to the environment. As a candidate, Biden made the environment one of his central issues, though he has said he does not support the so-called Green New Deal favored by the progressive wing of his party. He put forward his own aggressive plan for what he called a climate change revolution.
We're going to invest $1.7 trillion in securing our future so that by 2050, the United States will be 100% clean energy economy with net zero emissions. And by the end of my first term, we will have an enforcement mechanism in place to make sure we stay on track to get there. No, we're going to make record-breaking.
Though Biden can achieve some of his plan through executive action, and polls show that two-thirds of Americans support government action on climate change, his program will require the cooperation of Congress, and Democrats hold the slimmest possible majority in the Senate. Bill McKibben, a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a noted environmentalist, joins me to discuss Biden's plan for the environment and how to create a virtuous circle in public policy from the ground up. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Dorothy, always a pleasure to be with you. And on a new day.
A new day. You have spent your entire adult life wrestling with the climate problem and have many successes to show for it. But the last 4 years in particular have set back worldwide efforts on this front. Remind us just how high the stakes are. You've talked about the urgency of taking immediate action to reduce the rise in temperature by a single degree, saying that it could easily make the difference between a civilization that survives and one that collapses.
The thing that we have to worry most about here is time. We're not used to, in our political life, to crises that come with time limits, but this one does. And the world's climate scientists have made it very clear that if we have not, as they put it, fundamentally transformed the energy system by the end of this decade, by 2030, and they defined that as cutting emissions in half, then the chances of meeting the targets that we set at Paris just 5 years ago are out the window. So the time is not our friend, and wasting 4 years of the Trump administration put us even deeper in an already fearsome hole. So it's a very good thing that the Biden crew has come out slugging at the start. We'll hope that they can keep up that kind of momentum.
And Biden mentioned 2050, but you've pointed out that we're really talking about 2030. We're just facing a catastrophe of almost unimaginable proportions.
Yes. And, you know, we're going to start seeing some of those effects showing up very rapidly. 2020, if it hadn't been the year of the pandemic, would have been the year of the out-of-control wildfire in Australia, in California, in Siberia, in South America. The last two hurricanes of the record Atlantic hurricane season smashed into Central America with extraordinary force. We think that the damage in Honduras may have been equivalent to 40% of the country's GDP. And that means that there are people who will have no choice but to head north towards the border because their farms and lives have been ruined. And of course, not by anything they did. Honduras didn't cause the climate crisis. We did.
You recently wrote in your New Yorker newsletter that the central battle, at least for the next few years, is between big oil and big hope and anger. Could you tell us what you meant by that?
Yeah, we now know, and this is in large measure thanks to great investigative reporting in a lot of places over the last 5 or 6 years, that big oil knew everything there was to know about climate change, you know, in the 1980s, before it was a public issue. They Exxon scientists were able to predict with uncanny accuracy what the temperature and the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere would be in 2020. But they didn't tell the rest of us. Instead, they, you know, erected this enormous edifice of climate denial and disinformation. And as a result, we've wasted decades that we should have been hard at work. Their power continues, but it lessens somewhat. It lessens somewhat because a Democratic administration is not quite as vulnerable to it as a Republican one. And it lessens somewhat because their financial position and hence their political power is deteriorating. You know, 10 years ago, Exxon was the largest company on Earth, and now they're not even the largest energy company. NextEra Energy, a renewable company based in Florida, passed them in market capitalization this autumn. So one hopes that that power is fading, and as it fades, that we'll be able to start enacting the obvious common sense things that people have been talking about for many, many years, but we've never been able to overcome the political power of the fossil fuel industry.
So these oil and gas companies are fighting for survival. How do you continue to persuade them to do what's in the best interest of the planet?
Well, I don't think actually you persuade them to do what's in the best interest of the planet. If they were had any interest in that, they would have shifted long ago. I'm afraid you have to convince them they have no choice at all. And partly that's through the kind of increased government regulation that makes it harder for them to do things. Canceling the Keystone Pipeline was a great first day step. But you also, and this is what's increasingly happening in movements around the world, people are managing to start shutting down the flow of financial capital to the fossil fuel industry. They get a lot of money from governments, but they get a hell of a lot more money from banks and insurance companies and asset managers. And that's starting to shift. I mean, the French central bank said 2 days ago that they would no longer be in the business of providing money for the fossil fuel industry. Yesterday, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce put out a statement calling for action on climate change. They've been one of the most effective advocates for doing nothing for a long time, but clearly they know that that's not going to work anymore. I think we're going to see big changes at the Fed, the Treasury, and the Securities and Exchange Commission that make it much harder for the fossil fuel industry to keep siphoning money out of our financial system. And Janet Yellen, in her testimony for Treasury Secretary the day before yesterday, said that there's going to be a climate hub within her office now. And what that means, I think, is that the U.S. will be joining the European financial regulators, who have become very insistent that all companies and lenders start taking climate risk into their calculations. As she pointed out, not only do we face an existential risk to life on planet Earth, but this is the biggest single existential risk that our financial system faces, many times larger even than the housing bubble that took us down in 2008.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Maybe get into some detail about those executive orders that Biden signed yesterday. You've been very active in revoking the Keystone XL pipeline. Maybe give us just a few of the highlights.
Well, rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement is, I mean, it sort of fits the definition of a no-brainer. I mean, this was on the list of stupid things that Trump did, you know, was very high up there. And you can tell just how how dumb it was by the fact that almost no one is upset that we're rejoining. The only exception seems to be Senator Cruz. So the Paris Climate Accord is a big deal. The U.S. historically is the biggest contributor to carbon in the atmosphere. It was absurd that we were the only country in the world not engaged in this fight. And the idea that it somehow is economically perilous for the U.S. to take climate change seriously is the most regressive idea possible. Clearly, this is going to be the most important economic transition of this century. And clearly, the countries that take it seriously are going to prosper as a result. And the ones that don't are going to find themselves dealing not only with the effects of runaway climate change, but the effects of an antiquated economy.
Yeah, interestingly, talking about the change in the zeitgeist, the other branch of government here that plays a big role are the courts. And just before Biden's inauguration, Trump had a big loss on his attempt to gut the rules limiting power plant emissions. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. The Obama administration had put in place, as you'll recall, a clean power plan that regulated coal-fired power plants in particular, made life hard for them. The Trump administration revoked that, but in its usual haste, ineptitude, and incompetence, it did a poor job of it, as the appeals court pointed out. The appeals court said that indeed the EPA had the right and the duty to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, and that doesn't mean that we go right back to where we were before. The Biden administration will have to do the work of putting together a plan again. And of course, there's no guarantee, and this hangs over all kinds of climate legislation, there's no guarantee that the newly reconstituted Supreme Court will allow them to do very much going forward. It's one of the reasons, I think, why we've got to be careful not to put all our eggs in legislative action basket, because the Supreme Court can turn over that basket if it wants, and there are signs that it may want to do just that.
Let's talk about the climate team that Biden has assembled. You talked about John Kerry as the climate czar, a new position as Secretary of State under Barack Obama. Kerry helped negotiate the Paris Climate Agreement and the Iran nuclear deal. What is his mandate exactly? And are you concerned at all by his past indications of some friendliness toward big oil?
I think that Kerry is fully engaged in the climate fight. And I think it was an important announcement that he would be in charge of the international part of our climate policy. It sent the strong message that a former Secretary of State was going to be doing this. I mean, that brings a lot of gravitas to this. Similarly, his domestic climate czar or czarina counterpart, Gina McCarthy, was the former head of the EPA. In her time away from office, has been running the NRDC, one of our premier environmental organizations, and she's been outspoken in her advocacy for climate justice. So, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better team of people, I think.
And what about Deb Haaland, Biden's choice for Secretary of the Interior?
Well,
I know you were vocal.
Yes, that nothing made me happier than seeing Deb Haaland.
I thought so.
In part because it's one of those beautiful poetic twists that history occasionally provides. Deb Haaland, formerly the congresswoman from New Mexico, was the first Native American woman elected to Congress, or one of the first two on the same night. And she'll be the first Native American cabinet member in American history. And her post as Secretary of the Interior gives her control over about 20% of the acreage of the United States, 20% of the land that her ancestors once controlled. There's something quite beautiful about that. And it's a reminder that the rise of indigenous environmentalism has been a big part in these shifts in the zeitgeist that we're seeing. Biden canceled the Keystone Pipeline, which was very good. There are two other remaining pipeline battles, both of which have indigenous leaders in starring roles. One, the Dakota Access Pipeline that you'll remember from the protests at Standing Rock. The other, called Line 3 across Minnesota, where, as we speak, there are many, many Native activists camped out in the cold along the upper Mississippi trying to block construction.
What can consumers and concerned citizens do to ensure as much meaningful change as possible in the next decade, especially when it comes to big oil? Maybe start with the fossil fuel divestment movement.
Yeah, the divestment movement continues to expand and grow. It got a lot bigger than any of us who started it ever anticipated. I think by some measures, it's the largest anti-corporate campaign in history. We're at about $15 trillion now worth of endowments and portfolios that have divested from fossil fuel. The most recent addition to that list is the New York State's $226 billion pension fund announced that it would finally be joining in. But this past year has seen, you know, universities like Oxford and Cambridge and Georgetown and so on. It's seen the Queen, who started divesting her holdings, and the Pope, who's made profound demands for divestment. Short of Beyonce, I don't know what other world leaders we're supposed to get, you know, to endorse this thing. And it's really starting to have a huge effect. Shell Oil said in their annual report a year ago that divestment had become a material risk to its business, which I was happy to hear, because Shell's business is a material risk to planet Earth. So I think that will continue, and people can figure out many ways to help. The idea that we can make big change as individuals at this point is probably pretty illusory. I mean, I'm really proud of the solar panels all over my roof and the electric car they're attached to, and on and on. But I don't try to fool myself that that's how we're going to win this. The most important thing that individuals can do is be a little less individual and join together with others in movements big enough to make change. And we see those happening all around us. The Sunrise Movement, young people demanding action on a Green New Deal or something like it, they've been a big part of what's brought the Biden platform to where it is.
Well, and Greta Thunberg alone.
Yeah. Fridays for the Future, Greta's movement is, and we all know Greta, and we should. She's magnificent. But the good news is there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs all over the planet with 10 million followers in high school and junior high school. And they're helping with this shift in the zeitgeist that in the end is the crucial thing. People's sense of what's normal and natural and obvious is in the end what determines how much and how quick we can get our political life to change. And by those counts, we're winning. You know, when we do polls, even of Republicans, even of conservative Republicans, they want more government support for renewable energy. They want people taking action on climate change. That's, you know, some of them are because they saw Greta Thunberg, and some of them are because they looked out the window and saw a wildfire coming over the next hill, you know. So change is coming. But the question is, and this goes back to where we began, can it come fast enough? We have to unbuild the fossil fuel system that undergirds our economy and replace it in real time with a renewable energy system. That's within the realm of the theoretically possible, but it's going to take really concerted effort. And I will say that at least at the start, the Biden administration seems eager to make that kind of concerted effort.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's great to have you on for the first podcast of the Biden administration and to be somewhat hopeful on the most critical issue confronting everyone in the world.
Amen. Many thanks, Dorothy.
Bill McKibben, a contributing writer to The New Yorker, is a founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org and the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. His most recent book is Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.